Today we've got a very interesting subject on which to end, if you like, this Parliament and this session. We've got Jonathan Powell with us, who I first met many years ago in the embassy in Washington, and since then he has been doing a number of very important jobs, all related to conflict resolution, which, as many of you know, is also a subject close to my heart. He is now the Chief Executive of Intermediate, which is a charity he founded in 2011 to work on conflict resolution. In April last year, he was appointed by the Prime Minister as his special envoy to the Libyan transition. He was, before that, Chief of Staff to Tony Blair from 1995 to 2007, and from 1997 to 2007 was also Chief British Negotiator on Northern Ireland. He's written a number of books. He's author of one, The Great Hatred, Little Room, Making Peace in Northern Ireland. Also, The New Machiavelli, How to Wield Power in the Modern World. And his new book, Talking to Terrorists, How to End Armed Conflicts. We've asked him today to speak to us on the title, From Northern Ireland to Libya, How to End Armed Conflicts. That's quite a challenging title, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say to us. As usual, I'm going to ask him to speak for about 30 minutes, and after that we will open it up to question and answer. And at 2 o'clock on the dot, I will, as usual, close the meeting. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Michael, and thank you for inviting me here. I feel a little bit diffident talking about Northern Ireland in the presence of Michael, who was the first British minister since Lloyd George to meet Sinn Féin and wrestle with them after the first ceasefire, and Douglas, of course, and John Taylor, who I see back there ready to heckle if I get anything wrong on Northern Ireland, John Alderdice. So I feel very diffident to talk too much about Northern Ireland. What I'm going to do is talk a little bit about the lessons I took from Northern Ireland and whether they're generally applicable, and then come back to Libya at the end. And if you want to talk more about Libya or more about ISIL or whatever, we can do that in the conversation afterwards. And I will talk strictly for just 30 minutes. I fell into Northern Ireland really by accident. I'd been at the embassy in Washington doing the Northern Ireland portfolio and looking after people like John when they used to come out to Washington. Tony Blair, when he came into office, decided he was going to make Northern Ireland a real priority. He used his electoral victory to go straight into Northern Ireland. His first visit outside of London was to Balmoral, the agricultural fair, and the very unlikely setting for a political speech surrounded by huge bulls and very, very woolly sheep and the rest of it, and very rubicund farmers. But he did it in order to try and reassure the unionist population, who were suspicious of a new Labour government. He went in there, he made a speech in which he said he did not expect a united Ireland to happen in his lifetime. And then he spent a huge amount of time as Prime Minister on Northern Ireland, wrestling with the issue, pushing it and shoving it, and used me as his gopher, basically, to try and keep the thing going. And I spent 10 years, once or twice a week often, crossing the Irish Sea to go and deal with Northern Ireland. And at the time, it was the most frustrating, the most enervating, the most annoying, the most difficult subject I'd ever had to deal with. But in retrospect, it was the most important thing I did in my life, or I'm likely to do in my life, and something I am very proud of. Although the real credit for it should actually go to the politicians in Northern Ireland themselves, who were the ones who made the sacrifices and had the leadership to make it work. I have to say that I was not always in favour of talking to terrorists. The first time I met Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness, I refused to shake their hands. They had injured my father in an ambush in 1940 in Northern Ireland, the IRA had. My brother Charles, who worked for Mrs. Thatcher, had been on their death list for 8 years. I'd just spent a year in Washington trying to stop Gerry Adams getting a visa, ultimately unsuccessfully. So I declined to shake his hand, and shake their hand, as did Alistair Campbell, actually. But Tony Blair was rather more sensible about it. He shook hands as he would with anyone else. We went immediately afterwards for a walkabout in a very strongly Protestant part of East Belfast in a shopping centre, and we were mobbed by a crowd of old grannies, Hell's grannies, who started throwing rubber gloves at him. And Tony was mystified. He thought it was a protest about washing up. I had to explain that he should have been wearing gloves if he was going to shake hands with a terrorist. And when I look at the conflicts I've studied for this book I've just written, it's interesting how often the handshake is such a difficult issue for groups from Guatemala to Indonesia to the Philippines to actually get over. About 3 days after that first meeting, I got a call from Martin McGuinness out of the blue, and he asked if I would come to Derry incognito, if I would in particular not tell the securocrats. So I asked Tony and he said go. So I got on a plane and I flew to Belfast, took a taxi to Derry and stood on a street corner feeling like a bit of an idiot, out of some sort of spy novel. And two guys with shaved heads turned up and shoved me into the back of a taxi saying, Martin sent us. And they drove me around and round Derry for about an hour until I was completely lost, and then pushed me out of the door by a modern little house on the edge of an estate. And I knocked on the door, and Martin McGuinness came to the door on crutches, making a rather inappropriate joke about kneecapping, which, as you'll remember, was the IRA's favoured way of punishing people by drilling holes through their knees. I spent 3 hours sitting there with Martin McGuinness. We made no breakthrough whatsoever. But over the next 10 years, I endlessly was crossing the IRC, sitting with them in different safe houses around the province. And it came home to me that it was because of that we were able to build a certain amount of trust. If I'd insisted they come to Downing Street, or I'd insisted they come to Stormont Castle, we would not have been able to get them to take the difficult steps they took. There is a limit to how much trust you can build in those sort of relationships. I remember in 2004, when we were negotiating late, the monks had very kindly given us dinner in Clonard Monastery Refectory. And the minute hand on my watch had come loose and was going backwards and forwards loosely, and I couldn't work out what time it was for my plane, and I was desperate to make the plane. Martin McGuinness very kindly said, oh, let me have your watch fixed for you. I'll take it to a very good watchmender at the end of my street in Derry. And I said, no, honestly, you really don't need to worry. Please, please don't worry about it. He insisted on taking it, and he took it away and gave it back to me at Leeds Castle 2 weeks later when we had the negotiations. And I, of course, had to give it to the security authorities, and they took it apart and broke the minute hand, and I had to have it fixed again at great cost because they've been looking for trackers and bugs. So there's a limit to what you can do in terms of trust. What I wanted to do in writing the book that I've just done is to see if any of those lessons from Northern Ireland applied elsewhere. There is no Northern Ireland model. Sometimes people are ridiculously literal about this. In the Basque country, for example, people on the Etta side tend to say we want to do exactly what we did in Northern Ireland. That's completely inappropriate. The causes in Northern Ireland, the way it was solved, I wouldn't wish the De Hont system on anyone in any other country, which was part of the solution we came to in Northern Ireland. So, but what does seem to jump out, if you look at the conflicts over the last 30 years, is there is a clear pattern to what works and what doesn't work. And it works in, or it fails in Sri Lanka if you do it that way. It can work if you do it the other way in El Salvador. So however different the conflicts are, there is some sort of pattern. And the first lesson, I think, is that we always say that we won't talk to terrorists, and yet we nearly always end up talking to terrorists. We certainly did it as part of decolonisation. In 1919, Lloyd George said that he would never talk to that murder gang. 2 years later, he was reaching out, making a secret channel to the IRA, and to Andy Cope, a former customs office official, and then he turned that into a negotiation and negotiated the Treaty of 1922. We did it again with Begin after he blew up the King David Hotel. He was a terrorist. We tried to hunt him down. We later treated him as a statesman. We did the same with Kenyatta in Kenya. We locked him up in the north of Kenya. We called him a terrorist. We let him out to negotiate independence with him. He became president, and we welcomed him as a statesman. We did the same with Makarios in Cyprus. We exiled him to the Seychelles as a terrorist. We brought him back to negotiate independence and as the first president. So there seems to be some sort of collective amnesia. And by the way, it's not just us who are guilty of this. If you look at the French in Algeria, had exactly the same pattern. With François Mitterrand, who was Minister of Interior at the time of the FLN First Rising, said we will never negotiate with these terrorists. That's what de Gaulle in the end did. So we forget how to do it, and we leave it too late. So General Petraeus said of Iraq that Americans left it far too late to deal with people with American blood on their hands. Should have started the negotiations much earlier. Hugh Gaitskill probably encapsulates it best when he said that all terrorists end up with tea at the Ritz as guests of Her Majesty's government. And that, if we look at our history, is pretty much what has happened. There are arguments, of course, against trying to talk to terrorists. The first is appeasement that George W. Bush put forward in a speech in the Knesset in 2004, where he said talking to terrorists was tantamount to dealing with Hitler at the time of Munich. I think he maybe misunderstands appeasement in terms of talking to Hitler was a perfectly sensible thing to do in the late 1930s to try and avoid another conflagration across Europe. Thinking he could be bought off with a large chunk of Czechoslovakia was a mistake. Talking to terrorists is not appeasement. Agreeing with terrorists would be appeasement. But usually when governments talk to terrorists, they're not about to agree with them. We would never have agreed to a united Ireland at the barrel of a gun, despite the wishes of the people of Northern Ireland. However long we had talked to Sinn Féin, we never even discussed that with Sinn Féin. We discussed other things like power sharing, human rights, and so on. So I don't really feel that argument holds up. The second argument, which has certainly more to it, is the legitimisation of terrorists. People fear that if you talk to a terrorist group, you are giving it legitimacy. And certainly armed groups are endlessly seeking legitimacy. That's what they really crave, what they want. However, if you do talk to them, what tends to happen is you give them a very temporary sort of legitimacy. In Caguan, the talks between the FARC and the Colombian government in 1999 to 2001, the FARC certainly got legitimacy from those talks. But when they rejected the compromise on offer, when they went back to fighting, they lost that legitimacy and actually ended up in a worse position than they had been before. They were seen as narco-terrorists. So that legitimization is a short-term thing and something, in my view, is worth paying to pursue the chance of peace. Now, the thing that really takes me to the notion that you do need to talk to terrorists is the fact that if you look back over the last 30 years, there doesn't seem to be a very good alternative in the end if you want to end up with a peaceful settlement. Hugh Ward, who is the chief constable in Northern Ireland, said, I think quite correctly, there is no example anywhere in the world of terrorism being policed out. That if there is a political cause, in the end you will have to find a political solution to it. General Petraeus said of Iraq that there was no way that we could kill and capture our way out of an industrial-scale insurgency. And I think he was right. Now, the academics have looked for lots of different ways in which terrorism might end. They've talked about decapitation, for example, which is where you remove the leader and the armed group fails. However, history doesn't really favour that argument very much. If you look at the PKK, when Abdullah Öcalan was captured, it is true that the PKK ceased its violence temporarily. But the violence actually then went up while he was in jail rather than ending. So it doesn't seem, again, if you look at Sheikh Qasim and Hamas, you find the same thing. So decapitation doesn't seem to work. The argument that's put forward at Sri Lanka shows that there is some sort of military solution to a terrorist problem. And it is true that the Rajapaksa government managed to defeat the Tamil Tigers quite successfully. But if you look at it in some more detail, it doesn't look like a model that could apply anywhere else. If you talk to the Norwegian negotiators who worked between the Tamil Tigers and the Sri Lankan government, they say that Prabhakaran was always seen as a military genius, but he turned out to be a military fool in the end. He failed to actually fight a guerrilla campaign and instead, out of hubris, fought a conventional campaign against the government and was defeated. Had he fought a guerrilla campaign, he'd still be out there in the bush fighting now. Secondly, the methods used by the Sri Lankan government at Nandikal Lagoon to end the insurgency and the number of civilians killed there is not something that any Western government could conceive of doing if they wanted to end the terrorist structure. So it's no solution that we could find. And lastly, unless you address the political issue, which is the Tamil desire for autonomy of some sort, you will not solve the problem. And that is one of the reasons, of course, the Rajapaksa government has lost the election and been replaced by a government willing to talk to. So if you look back at history, there seem to be very few examples of ending an armed group that has real political support. I'm not talking about a Baader-Meinhof or Symbionese Liberation Army. Groups that are fractional have really no significant political support. They are not the same sort of category as an ANC, an FMLN, a GAM in Indonesia that have genuine political support. Now, it is very difficult for democratic governments to talk to armed groups when they are killing the innocent civilians in the countries concerned. And governments often deny that they are doing so. John Major, who deserves a huge amount of credit for getting the Northern Ireland peace process going, stood up in Parliament and said that he would never talk to Gerry Adams, it would turn his stomach to do so, at exactly the same moment that he was corresponding with Martin McGuinness, and thank goodness he did. If he hadn't been doing that, we would never have got to the end of the conflict in Northern Ireland. I was talking the other day to Colin Parry, whose son Tim Parry died in the Warrington bomb at 12 years old. And Colin says that if he had known when Tim died in his arms the British government was corresponding with the IRA, he would have been horrified. If someone had told him 6 months later that the British government was corresponding with the IRA, he'd have been delighted because he'd have known his son was not going to die in vain and there was a chance of peace happening. So people understand why it is that governments behave in that way. In the case of Spain, the Spanish government, every Spanish prime minister since Franco has talked so far, has talked to ETA and denied that they were talking to ETA. Adolfo Suarez, who was prime minister immediately after Franco, stood up in the Cortes and said he was not talking to ETA. The leader of the opposition, Felipe González, stood up and said, but you told me over dinner last night you were talking to ETA. Suarez got up again and said, no, I'm not talking to ETA. So people, governments always behave in the same way. They try and open some sort of link that allows you to make this progress secretly, often through intelligence agencies, as we did in Northern Ireland and as the South Africans did in the case of the ANC. It's one thing to mention in terms of democratic governments. One thing that makes negotiations much easier in these circumstances is bipartisanship. We were very lucky here in Britain that when Tony Blair became leader of the Labour Party, he changed the policy on Northern Ireland. He decided to support John Major, whatever he was doing, even if he disagreed with it, because he thought that was the right thing to do. And then when we won the election and took over, the Conservative Party continued to support what we were doing. That made it a whole lot easier to actually reach a conclusion in Northern Ireland than we would have been able to otherwise. Spain has exactly the opposite problem, where the PP opposition made life hell for the socialist government in Spain trying to make peace with ETA. They adopted a policy of crispación, of trying to attack them on every single issue, and it made it enormously difficult for Zapatero to actually get to an agreement. The enormous number of things I'd like to say, but I'm going to skip most of them so I can get to Libya and that. But let me just touch on a couple of things. Firstly, from Northern Ireland, that in order to actually open a channel, and which is what happens in these negotiations, so you open a channel secretly, happens in nearly every negotiation from Colombia, South Africa, where they started talking to Mandela in jail, and then to the ANC in Switzerland. The point of that contact is to try and build some sort of understanding, some sort of trust. I used to say in Northern Ireland that if we ended a conversation after only half an hour, we'd have only got to 1689. And there were 300 years more of grievances to get through if we kept the meeting going. And there were two very different histories, and we had to be prepared to listen and understand what the two sides were saying. And it isn't just about listening, you actually have to hear. It's not just sitting quiet. You have to hear the nuances of what people are saying, what they are not saying that they said last time, what they said this time, they didn't say last time, and where are the patterns that you can succeed. There's an educative process that really takes quite a long time that people don't understand. If you think about these armed groups, they are often living physically in ghettos or metaphorically in ghettos, talking only to each other, talking only to people who share their views. It takes a long time of talking to them for them to understand what the real alternatives are and for governments to understand what is the logic behind what they do. So if you have a channel, it isn't always the right time to actually get into a negotiation. My argument is you should always be prepared to talk to terrorists, but negotiations will only succeed in certain circumstances. And there are two key factors, I think, again, drawn from Northern Ireland, but seem to work in most examples. The first is a mutually hurting stalemate. When I first got to Libya, I thought, oh, good, there's a stalemate. We'll be able to get some progress. What I hadn't observed was it wasn't a mutually hurting stalemate. It was a stalemate that where both sides could gain a bit more money, gain a bit more territory, and could keep fighting each other. It wasn't something that caused pain for them, therefore they weren't prepared to negotiate. In the case of Northern Ireland, I think the British military realised towards the end of the 70s, early 80s, that they could contain the IRA forever, but they were unlikely to be able to wipe it out by military force alone. They understood the need for political talks. In the case of Adams and McGuinness, I think that it was about the mid-1980s, you know, they joined the Republican movement quite young. By the mid-1980s, they were well past fighting age, and they could see their nephews and nieces, cousins, sons and daughters getting arrested, getting killed, and they understood this could go on forever, and they weren't going to be able to conclude it by fighting. They weren't going to get the Brits out by fighting, and that's when they reached out first to John Hume, then to the Irish government, and then to the British government through the correspondence. And if you look at El Salvador or anywhere else, you'll see that mutually hurting stalemate is usually what you need to have in place if you're going to get to success. If it is not hurting enough, for example, if you take Cyprus, where for the Greek Cypriots there is very little pain in where they are at the moment, then you are unlikely to make progress. It's only if staying in that situation is uncomfortable. The second item that seems to be absolutely essential for concluding these sort of negotiations is strong leadership, and strong leadership on both sides. In South Africa, you wouldn't have succeeded without Nelson Mandela, but nor would you have succeeded without F.W. de Klerk. You needed to have both of them to be able to make progress. In Northern Ireland, we were very lucky to have David Trimble and Ian Paisley on the unionist side, who made huge sacrifices politically and personally in order to get to peace and deserve huge credit for it. And we had Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness on the other side, who actually risked their lives as well as their political futures to try and make peace. But we also had Bertie Ahern and Tony Blair, who were in power for 10 years, and that cooperation between the British and Irish governments, again, was fundamental to reaching success in Northern Ireland. In his autobiography, Tony Blair accuses me of saying that he had a messiah complex, and that's what enabled him to conclude peace in Northern Ireland. Actually, it was Mo Molam, who some of you will remember, who had quite a colourful turn of phrase, who said that Tony thought he was effing Jesus, and that's why he concluded it. But that's different but related to it. And if you don't have a leader who actually believes the problem can be solved and believes that they can do it, then you won't get to success. Tony Blair believed it could be solved and believed he could do it. And again, if you look around the world, those cases that succeeded, you tend to have those sort of leaders in place. It can often also be a result of life-changing illnesses. I mean, the Ian Paisley's case is quite well known, I suppose, when in 2004 he went into hospital, very nearly died, and came out and told Tony Blair that he had a close encounter with his makeup and wanted to end life as Dr. Yes rather than Dr. No. And thereafter, he really did, in the meetings with the DUP, even when his party were against him, he was pushing to try and get to an agreement in a quite different way than he had been before. The same thing is true of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. When Chavez got cancer, he started going to church twice a day, but he also tried to get to peace in Colombia. It was he, having supported the FARC and given them a base in Venezuela, who pushed the FARC into a negotiation in the last year or so of his life in a quite different sort of way. Now, in terms of actual negotiations, I spend quite a lot of time in the book talking about this, so I won't spend long on it, but I can have a complaint for many of my old Foreign Office colleagues who are here. When I joined the Foreign Office in 1979, we had one day of training when we started, and we had a copy of Harold Nicholson's book on diplomacy, which is a wonderful example of British understatement, because it was published first in 1939. If I'm right, yes, 39, and then republished in 1947. And the opening line of the 47 edition is, many interesting events have occurred since this book was first published. we were also given a guide to placement about where you should sit at dinner parties, which is extremely useful, but we were given no training on negotiation at all, and I've spent my entire career, both in the Foreign Office and subsequently, working on negotiations without any expertise. I won't go into all of the examples, but just one thing, because it's important in the case of Libya, which is that a negotiation is not an event. You don't suddenly get to an agreement and that solves the problem. You have an agreement because people don't trust each other. An agreement doesn't make them trust each other. It's only when they start implementing the agreement that they begin to start trusting each other. So you've got an arc from people who don't trust each other trying to get to people who do trust each other. The agreement is just one step along the way. And what you need is a process to get you to that. I think that Shimon Peres has the best way of summing this up, the master of the one-liner. And he talks about the Middle East peace process. He says that everyone knows what the outcome will be in the Middle East peace process in terms of territory, in terms of refugees, even in terms of Jerusalem. But there's no process to get us there. So he says the good news is there's light at the end of the tunnel, and the bad news is there's no tunnel. And that's what you're trying to do as a negotiator, is to build a process, to build a tunnel that will get you there. The second thing to remember is that when you get to an agreement, a breakthrough agreement, that is not the solution, that is not the end of the negotiation. If you think about the Oslo Accords, when they were published, everyone celebrated, particularly on the Palestinian side, but also mainly on the Israeli side. But no one did anything to try and implement them. No one did anything to try and put them into practice. They crumbled and we had a second intifada. If we thought when we took off in our helicopters from Stormont on Good Friday 1998, we had solved the problem in Northern Ireland, we were sadly mistaken. It took us another 9 years to get the agreements implemented and to get the institutions up and running. So the hardest work in a negotiation is often after the agreement, not before the agreement, and that's where you need to apply yourself if you're going to succeed. Just one more Northern Ireland thing, and then let me go on to Libya, which is that a good deal of ingenuity is required in, which may also apply to Libya, to get to a solution, to get to a settlement. In the case of Northern Ireland, we negotiated the whole of the peace agreement between the DUP and Sinn Féin without them ever meeting. It was all done by shuttle diplomacy. Eventually, we got to an agreement where Ian Paisley agreed to sit down with Gerry Adams, and they agreed on everything, how long the meeting would last, where the TV cameras would be, what they'd discuss, but they would not agree where they would sit. Ian Paisley absolutely insisted on sitting opposite Gerry Adams, so they looked like rivals. And Adams insisted on sitting next to Paisley so that he looked like an equal. And we just could not get around that problem until a very bright Northern Ireland Office official came up with the idea of a new table, a diamond-shaped table, so they could sit next to each other and opposite each other at exactly the same time. And that managed to resolve the problem and get us to the final conclusion on that. Now, let me, in my last 5 minutes, move on to Libya, and we can discuss it much more in the discussion, because I know that's probably why many of you wanted to come along. Now, Libya is, like all of these cases, very different from the cases such as Northern Ireland, but also El Salvador or anyone else. But there will be some patterns that will work and some that won't. The first thing to understand about Libya, I feel, is that it is not Syria or Iraq. If you look at it in a telescope from London or from Washington, it tends to just look like a mess, battles going on. But what Libya does not suffer from are the sectarian divisions or the religious divisions that you have in Syria and Iraq. In Libya, everyone is basically a conservative Maliki Sunni. There are not driven by decisions. There are tribal groups, there are other divisions, but they're really, even between East and West, the divisions are not that substantial. So what the conflict is about power and money. And if a conflict is about power and money, it is often much easier to resolve than if it's born out of the sort of divisions that we have in Iraq and Syria. So that makes me relatively confident that you can find a conclusion in Libya in a way that will be much harder in Iraq and Syria. The problem, though, is that, if you like, Libya is the last bit of white space on the world map. It's never really had a government or institutions in the sense that we would understand them. Under Gaddafi, certainly, there were no institutions that we would recognise as a government. If you go back to the king, frankly, there was very little that would we would recognise, or even really under Italian colonialism, which was a particularly brutal form of colonialism. And not that we can be particularly proud of our own, but in that case, it didn't really establish institutions. And going back to the Turks before that, they sat on the coast and governed from there. So one of the problems is in trying to deal with a country without institutions, without a sense of a country as a whole, it is very, very difficult to persuade people to make compromises, to make people come to a conclusion that actually settles the problem. And very difficult, and this is the key problem at the moment, to persuade people to accept the legitimacy of anyone else. We find it very hard to get the people in the West to accept the legitimacy of the House of Representatives, and the House of Representatives will not accept the legitimacy of any of the bodies in the East. And we have the Supreme Court weighing in with decisions that complicate it even further. But it's actually a wider problem than just that. No one, Bernardino León, the UN envoy, brought together the different participants in his talks, people complained about, why are those people there, why am I not there? The basic problem in Libya is that all 6 million Libyans want to be at the negotiations, and we do not have a room big enough in which to put them all and get to such a conclusion. So we have to find a way of establishing legitimacy. And Dominic Asquith, who's here today, wrote a piece in the FT arguing very passionately on the legitimacy of the House of Representatives. But the problem with that is it's not, of course, accepted by the people in the West, and the people in the West control the territory. So the question is, how do we get to a resolution? Bernardino León has done remarkable things in his time as the UN envoy. He has managed, against all odds, to gather all of the people together, and all of the groups are sitting now in Morocco talking to each other. He's got them to agree on a sort of framework of what a national unity government might look like. But the problem is going to be moving beyond that, and there's always a negotiation. You can often get people to agree on the easy things first, but how do you get them to agree on the difficult issue of who should be in power, who should be the Prime Minister and National Unity Government, who should be the Deputy Prime Ministers, and how is that legitimacy going to be confirmed by the House of Representatives? Does the GNC, the rival body in the West, have any role in that? So we've managed to get into the process I was talking about. The question is, can we keep that process going? I always think of a bicycle metaphor, that once you've got a process going, you want it to keep going and not let the bicycle fall over, not let anyone walk out. There's a wonderful story that Michael may well remember about John Major and Ian Paisley, who had a fairly fractious relationship. And John Major saw Ian Paisley in his office, which he used the cabinet room downstairs in number 10 as a meeting room. And Ian Paisley behaved outrageously and accused John Major of lying. And John Major demanded that Ian Paisley withdraw his accusation, which he refused to do. And John Major said, well, if you don't withdraw it, I'm going to walk out. And Paisley refused to, so John Major walked out. What he'd forgotten was he just walked out of his own office and Ian Paisley sat there for the rest of the day and wouldn't leave. So if you do walk out, always be careful where you're walking out of. I'll come back because I'm going to run out of time in the discussion about Libya. But the crucial problem, in my view, is can we get that further jump in terms of solving the problem of legitimacy? And most of all, can we actually deal with the military issue? Because it's all very well coming up with a political agreement. We can come up with a national unity government. But if we can't go back to Tripoli that is occupied by militias, how on earth is it going to be better off than the current government sitting in a boat off the coast of Tobruk? So we have to find a way of dealing with those armed groups that I was talking about earlier, and many of those lessons that I've described, and above all, whether we actually are in a situation with a mutually hurting stalemate and with some real political leadership on both sides that I say seem to be the fundamentals to getting to a success in these circumstances. So in conclusion, trying to tie the whole thing together, the Americans have revised their approach to terrorism twice, once after after Afghanistan and once after Iraq. They revised their coin under the leadership of General Petraeus. And what they've done is they've gone from just a kinetic approach to saying they must learn the lessons of Malaya and deal with hearts and minds. And they've gone even further in the second revision talking about reconciliation, although what they mean by reconciliation is actually sort of buying off bits of groups, as with the Taliban. My argument is that you will not solve the problem of terrorism simply by military pressure down. But equally, you won't solve it simply by taking a soft political approach. You have to be prepared to combine all of the tools at your disposal. You have to be able to have the military pressure down. If you just have military pressure down, the people you're fighting will fight to the death and you'll never stop them. You have to offer them a political way out at the same time. Combining those two tools is the crucial element. The second lesson I take from a lot of this is that you may not succeed the first time when you're trying to manage talks like this. In Northern Ireland, we had Sunningdale in 1973. We had the Anglo-Irish Agreement in 1985. We had the Downing Street Declaration in 1993. None of them succeeded. But the Good Friday Agreement didn't come from nowhere. The Good Friday Agreement was built on those previous failures. It's an accretion of... And again, if you look at conflicts around the world, it's nearly always this pattern of a series of failed negotiations that lead to a success. Seamus Mallon, of course, described the Good Friday Agreement as Sunningdale for slow learners, because it had very much the same measures in it as Sunningdale had had in terms of power sharing, but it had taken that much longer for us to get to it. So my optimistic conclusion is that all conflicts, including Libya, are soluble, even the Middle East peace process, is soluble, even though it has failed so many times before. There's an interesting thing that happens when you get to an agreement. Northern Ireland was considered to be insoluble. Churchill thought Northern Ireland was insoluble. Mrs. Thatcher thought Northern Ireland was insoluble. When we got to the agreement, everyone said it was inevitable. They said, well, of course there's an agreement. The agreement because of the 9/11. There's an agreement because of the economic circumstances had changed. Actually, none of these conflicts are insoluble, and nor is it inevitable that any of them will be solved. And if you think either of those things, you're going to fail because you will not understand what needs to happen. And what does need to happen is we need to have some leadership, people prepared to take risks to get to a settlement. You need to have patience. And above all, you need to have some inclination to learn from what went before. Thank you very much.